We have a whole bunch of penguins here in the aquarium in Boston, which is one of my favorite things to go and see at the aquarium.
A bunch of penguins right here in our studio.
We could have penguins here in the studio. You never know. Welcome once again to Free Associations from the Boston University School of Public Health, the Public Health and Medical Journal Club podcast for anyone as confused by the latest health study as I am by the sound of my own voice. Okay, so we get to listen to these podcasts before we put them out just to make sure there's, you know, we're happy with the quality. So I've gotten most people hate the sound of their own voice, and I would put myself in that category, but I've gotten very used to listening to it. But I've had two experiences recently where I was not expecting to hear my own voice, and it really kind of freaked me out. The first I had mentioned to you all, but I didn't say it on air, which is at one point last year I was sitting working upstairs in my house, and I could hear a podcast downstairs, and it was so faint I couldn't really totally make it out, but it kept, every once in a while I'd get a little snippets of words, and then I heard a phrase that I thought, this is a phrase I've only ever heard a friend of mine use. I thought, are they interviewing my friend? And no, I started listening closer and realized, no, it was us. My wife was listening to our podcast, and so that was
kind of strange. A meta experience though, of listening to someone else, you know, kind of observing someone else listen to you.
So then it's even more so, because then over break, we were down on a family vacation and I went out for a run, and I was coming back and we were with family, and my sister-in-law, who is an avid listener of this podcast, was running in the other direction, holding her phone and listening. No, not with headphones, but out loud running down the beach.
No headphones.
I do that too. That's a generational marker, I think.
I don't know. It also could have been because she knew she was going to pass me. I don't know. But it took, I didn't realize at first what it was. And then I sort of stopped. It's so disorienting. Do you all both hate listening to the sound of your own voice?
I was just going to add, I think this also speaks to the fact that your family probably constitutes a solid 95% of our listeners.
Oh, yeah.
Are related to you somehow. Yeah.
Cannot do it.
Yeah. It's really hard.
Do it for a second.
It's really hard. I wonder if there've got to be people though who have wonderful melodious voices who love the sound of their own voice.
That's probably a bad signal if you love this. I end up when I listen to the episodes, I end up fast forwarding through the sections where I know I'm talking a lot.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, I am Matt Fox from the Departments of Epidemiology and Global Health at the Boston University School of Public Health. And I'm joined by Dr. Jessica Liebler from the Department of Environmental Health at the BU School of Public Health. Welcome, Jess.
Thanks, Matt.
And we are joined by returning host John Jay from the Department of Community Health Sciences at the BU School of Public Health. Welcome back, John.
Thank you. Always exciting to be here.
Good to have you. And I have good news. We got another review. So this one says innovative and laugh out loud. It says my best podcast discovery of 2023, loving the back catalog, even though I'm a nutritionist, Sima in New Zealand. Oh. So another 5-star rating for us.
Thank you, Sima. That's very kind.
Thank
you.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've gone global.
We're taking over the New Zealand's airwaves. And of course, another reminder to go over to Apple Podcasts or whatever your podcast app or site is to give us a rating and help others find us. And now on to the show. So today in our first segment, which is our Journal Club segment, we're going to look at a study on mobility and segregation. And I will say up front, economic segregation. And I will just say up front, this is probably one of the studies that is our least health focused specifically, but it has implications for health. And therefore, it was just such an interesting study. We really wanted to talk about it. Then the second part of the podcast, which is our deep dive, we will talk about AI for hypothesis generation, but I venture to guess we'll just talk about AI in general and how much we are convinced it's going to take over our lives.
That was your hypothesis.
Not
generated by AI.
It's entirely possible AI did generate that hypothesis. And then in our final segment, which is our amazing and amusing, we'll get into some things that make us laugh out loud. Or we may get an update on the Bachelor, but I'm told we may not.
Oh, no, I hope so. I was looking forward to that. Oh,
the Golden Bachelor.
Yes, sorry,
the
Golden course. Bachelor.
I'm always happy to talk about it.
Okay. Great. All right. Because I do think we need to revisit the fact that when you were here last, you talked about the Golden Bachelor. I specifically said I thought it was going to be a failure. You said I was wrong, and you were 100% right.
That's right.
And
it's a mega success.
It was a huge success, despite some of the sketchiness that went on. Okay. So in our first segment, so we're going to talk about an article, as I said, that looked at mobility and economic segregation. It was published in Nature, entitled Human Mobility Networks Reveal Increased Segregation in Large Cities. this was, again, it was published in Nature, which has the odd quirks of publishing the methods after, at the end, sort of after you found everything out. And it has the quirk of allowing authors to present a result in the title, which many journals won't let you do. First author was Hamed Nilforeshan of the Department of Computer Science at Stanford University in Stanford, California. I only found one headline on this, and this was in Science Mag, which said, "Big cities foster socioeconomic segregation. Here's how we can fix that." Always like an article that gives you the solution. So Jess, can you talk us through this one?
I can, sure. This was a really interesting paper with a level of complexity that was reminding me of that COVID paper we did on the very local level in terms of interventions.
Yeah.
So I do, if you have an interest in this to our dear listeners, I encourage you to take a look at this paper because there's a lot more in there than we'll be able to talk about.
And some cool maps.
Some really nice maps and figures. So just to step back by means of background briefly, economic segregation, as we know, has long been viewed as a serious social problem, and it is very prevalent in the United States. And so just again, as a further step back, as we talk about segregation in this paper, they are talking about economic segregation, socioeconomic segregation, not racial segregation, although we can discuss that a little bit in the correlations between the two. But the focus here is economic segregation. The authors note up front in the manuscript that income affects so many things. We're specifically focused in the United States, but globally also. Income affects where you live, who you marry, who your friends are, and economic segregation has been associated with economic immobility, health problems, and political polarization. So there is this theory that cities serve the function of an equalizing, and I'm using quotes here, mixing. Is it a mixing bowl? I know it's the melting pot and there's the mixing bowl. You know, the idea that cities bring people into contact with people who are different from them across many domains, including economically, but also racially, ethnically, religiously, politically, et cetera. Cities bring people together across difference because of economic opportunities that they host. And this is a longstanding sociological belief termed the cosmopolitan mixing hypothesis. So we've all heard this idea. The authors for this paper asked the question, is this really true? Is it really true that cities in the U.S. are less economically segregated than other areas in the country? And so to answer this question, they took a pretty novel approach. They were looking specifically for individual level data on both location as well as economic status. So I'm going to go through what they were doing and kind of how they were doing it. So their first question, is it true that cities in the U.S. are less economically segregated than other areas? They started off by looking at individual level location data, mobility data. And so this is data that's generated from the Safe Graph company, which is data, to my understanding, that you can kind of purchase. There's elements of it that are freely available and others of it that I think you can purchase from this company, which is cell phone tracking data. So this is cell phone tracking data on the individual level.
Anonymized.
Although tracked to your home and to your particular locations.
Yeah. So you could argue that it may not be anonymized in that you can figure out
pretty easily if you wanted to who someone was.
Yeah.
But yes, it is not associated with someone's name or other characteristics on the individual level other than their location. So individual level cell phone tracking data of cell phone pings 24 hours a day. So this was the mobility data that the authors used to look at this issue of where people are and how they move through space. Their next step was to identify economic status to try to see if people mix in ways that are related to their economic status, if they're set or if they're segregated by their own personal economic status. So to look at someone's economic status using the Safe Graph cell phone data, what they did is they first looked for the home address of an individual. And they did this by looking to see where the cell phone was during the night for extended periods, assuming this was where someone was sleeping and that was their home. So they used this nighttime location as the presumptive home address and then interfaced that presumptive home address with Zillow to generate the market rent at that address.
And for anyone who doesn't know what Zillow is?
Zillow is an app and a website where you can type in a residential address and it will give you the house value. If the house is for sale, you'll get information on that house. It will also give you kind of an estimate of rent, even if the house is purchased and not for rent.
Yep.
So it'll give you kind of a market estimate of rent so that you have the Zillow market rent at that particular location. And so this provided the individual level economic data on a more refined level than, for example, census block data, which is kind of local people, maybe 500 to 3,000 people, instead of looking at the census block on income or housing value. So they have this person's location. They also have an individual's home and the value of their home. So their next step, we're kind of taking this step by step. Their next step is they look to see how people interacted, or in their parlance, were exposed to each other during the daytime periods. So they look to identify a group of individuals that a specific person in their data set was exposed to within 50 meters within a 5-minute time frame. This was, interestingly to me, used as a proxy for visual integration. I think the idea that 50 meters, you could see someone. Mm-hmm. And 5 minutes, I think, was kind of a radius around maybe the precision of the cell phone ping, mm-hmm. kind of a conservative estimate that these two people were within visual distance of each other within a reasonable 5-minute time frame. And so this was the proxy for crossing paths with someone during the day, during the course of your daily activities. They then generated an exposure segregation metric as the correlation between a person's socioeconomic status as derived from the estimate of their monthly home rent, and then the mean socioeconomic status derived as the home rent value of everyone with whom they were exposed to through a path crossing at this 50-meter window during a 5-minute period. So they constructed this ratio of your socioeconomic status to the mean socioeconomic status in the denominator of all the people that you crossed paths with, according to their definition, and used a linear mixed effects model in interpreting that. The resulting measure is a ratio that would range from zero, which would reflect perfect integration, that there was no similarity between your socioeconomic status and the people you interacted with, to one, which would be perfect homogeny, so complete segregation, that you only interacted with people who had the same socioeconomic status as yourself. Okay, so the step-by-step cell phone data, individual level, individual movements over time, derived home address that they then ran through Zillow to get the monthly rent as an estimate. They then looked to see who was crossing whom using this metric of 50 meters and a 5-minute time frame. And then they generated this metric as a ratio to describe how segregated or integrated someone's daily interactions were. Okay. Just as a side note, I suppose, this exposure segregation metric that they generated on the individual level in this study is an individual extension of something called the Neighborhood Sorting Index, which I was interested to learn about, which is a more of a community level referent, a correlation of the person's individual socioeconomic status in the numerator, and the denominator is the mean socioeconomic status of the people within their census track. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that these authors did in sensitivity analysis is they compared their individual level ratio to this kind of community referent to see how they perform differently in this model. Their next step was to look at where people actually went, what kinds of locations in the parlance of this paper, they were POIs, points of interest, and which were the points of interest that drew people into contact with people who were different from them in particular, and what were the characteristics of these POIs. Okay, so this was kind of the framing of what they were doing. They did a lot of data cleaning and exclusions, and they ended up in the end, as we move into their results, with 9.6 million individual cell phones in their data set, reflecting 1.6 billion interactions across 382 cities in the United States, and the city's metropolitan statistical areas, the MSAs in the parlance, and nearly 3,000 counties in the United States. They found that exposure segregation was higher in the 10 largest cities in the United States compared to the MSAs with fewer than 100,000 people. And economic segregation was 67% higher in these largest cities compared to these smaller cities and communities. So they identified much greater economic segregation in larger cities compared to smaller communities.
Shocker.
Shocker. Using the data on the POIs, the points of interests, they then identified that cities were most segregated because there was a diversity of POIs that could serve different economic levels. And so this is an interesting conclusion that I think resonates and kind of makes a lot of sense. They gave the example of restaurants, for example. In large cities, there are many restaurants and many different types of restaurants that with different price points that can cater towards people at different socioeconomic levels. So provided opportunities for greater economic segregation. The most interaction, the least segregated spaces, occurred at POIs that bridge diverse neighborhoods and attracted people from across neighborhoods and socioeconomic groups. So shopping centers were an example of this in less dense areas. They called this, quote unquote, the bridge effect. If there are these locations that could bridge communities of different socioeconomic levels. And the authors were concluding that the bridge effect is a function of urban design, that this is something that urban planners can actively consider in efforts to reduce economic segregation and to build up development that would bridge different communities in this way. So the pattern of urban development and the location of these bridges, these hubs, they calculated a bridging index. They had many indices in this paper. One of the other ones was this bridging index. And they noted that the pattern and location of these bridge hubs was more important than race, inequality, population size in adjusted models. So in conclusion to this very complicated yet interesting analysis, they had kind of twofold, the conclusion. Number one, cities were much more economically segregated than the cosmopolitan mixing hypothesis would suggest, and were more segregated economically than smaller communities. That was their first conclusion. Second conclusion is that urban planning and design of these bridging hubs can actively reduce segregation, making a case for the role of urban planning in these social processes.
Super interesting. Very impressive summary. Two quick thoughts before I hand it over to John for his take. Just to note two things. One is this is largely a descriptive paper there, except for the stuff you mentioned at the end, which we can get into whether or not that is in fact causation, but they're certainly trying to explain what they're observing. And so, but largely speaking, this is descriptive. We're describing what is going on and a phenomenon that is different across locations, not the causes of it. Second, man, the computing power that this must have taken. 1.5 billion edges, meaning connections between people that you have to look for to try and figure out. And computer scientists have these, you know, clever ways of minimizing the amount of computing power that this actually takes, but it's still a really impressive analysis and you know, data exercise. John, what are your thoughts on this? Good study, bad study, and what'd you find interesting?
I found it super interesting. I thought the part of the discussion you referred to, Jess, around the idea that New York City has restaurants where you can get dinner for $10, right, $100, or $1,000, mm-hmm, whereas, you know, there might not be a market for that $1,000 right dinner in Buffalo, was a really nice way of kind of summing up what they found here. Stepping back, I think this is an important study for social epidemiologists because of the way it looks at activity spaces. I think there has been a stronger and stronger understanding of segregation as a driver of racial health disparities, economic health disparities. But because we teach students, you know, place really matters in terms of the social and physical environment you're exposed to. And people who live in neighborhoods that have less favorable social physical environment are more likely to experience worse health outcomes. There's also been a strong push towards looking at the reasons why we see these residential segregation patterns because of racism and other intentional policy forces that have driven certain people to be able to live in certain neighborhoods and others not. And so that gives you a really nice, neat picture of why we see these health disparities. And I think this is an interesting layer to come in and say, to complicate that picture,
yeah,
which is people are not exclusively exposed to the neighborhoods where they live. They're also exposed to the neighborhoods where they spend time. And those are that can be a wide range of neighborhoods.
Yeah. So it's super interesting. So we had, I presented, I can't remember when it was, for one of the amazing amusings that I presented a couple of episodes back, a similar study, which specifically named this kind of mixing where you're most likely to find people of your, of different socioeconomic status is places like Applebee's and the Olive Garden, which I thought was pretty interesting because here, actually, if you looked, restaurants do not, they come out as quite segregated in terms of their index. The places that were most integrated across economic distribution were performing arts centers, stadiums, and theme parks and historical sites, which, you know, I think we should probably talk a little bit about what this actually means, because if you go to a stadium, right, you go to watch the Red Sox play, are you spending a lot of time interacting with people of different socioeconomic statuses, or are you spending a couple hours for a very, like, people don't tend to, you know, the average person doesn't go to a Red Sox game every night. They go one, you know, time a year, maybe none, but for the people who go one or two games a season. And so I don't know. I mean, these are sort of places and theme parks as well. Like they're not places you go very often. And it's also not clear what the actual mixing means. So I'm just a little bit more unsure on what it actually means.
It was interesting. I mean, it's a very interesting point, because the issue of, is this meaningful integration? Obviously it's not on the surface meaningful integration. They have no way of understanding if two people had a conversation or they had any real interaction with each other than that they were in the same physical proximity.
Not even at the exact same time, close, very close,
right,
in time.
Right.
So it's sort of, you know, what does it mean? I think on average, you can certainly surmise that people are having more contact in the areas with more of this mixing. I have no issue with the overall measure, but the degree, I think, is something that we could question, because I think, you know, whenever you use data like this, that is where you have to impute all the information. You've got to figure out somebody's socioeconomic status. You got to figure out, you know, exactly whether or not two people were in the same space at the same time. You're going to get it wrong some of the time. And that's okay, as long as there's no real pattern to the, you know, no reasons driving it. But there are some cases where you might make the argument that there are. My assumption is, I don't know if this is true, but if we're talking about figuring out somebody's location by pinging of cell phone towers, there are fewer cell phone towers the more rural the location is. I would also assume there's more cell phone towers the higher the socioeconomic status. So, you know, those two things make it hard to quite tease out. I would also say Zillow probably does a pretty good job of getting the general idea of your socioeconomic status right. But there's a big difference between renting a place and owning a place. And that's not differentiated here, right, in terms of your overall wealth. So, you know, just lots of areas where I question the magnitude of what we're seeing, but I think the direction would certainly be indisputable.
I was less interested in the mixing, although, I mean, mixing could be important for health outcomes, maybe especially infectious disease transmission.
Right.
I was thinking about this more in terms of access to public resources. So I think, for example, if you go to Boston Common in Boston, this is a big public green space adjacent to a very affluent neighborhood.
Yep.
And I think the people who you might see there tend to be more economically diverse than you might see in some of the other large green spaces in Boston. I think in part because it is, for various reasons, it serves as one of these hubs. It's accessible by public transportation. There's public programming there. And I think it was interesting to see in this study that they found less mixing at parks in general,
right,
which is consistent with my impressions of particular sort of smaller parks or medium-sized parks in cities. I think part of why this is important is that those are things that are publicly funded and where policy can intervene on these types of segregation, lack of mobility, by making public resources more accessible across the full range of economic strata.
It's really interesting. I mean, my kind of takeaway from this paper was maybe a little bit of a blend of the you know, things that both of you have mentioned, where, as Matt was saying, this was a descriptive paper, kind of trying to describe segregation in the United States in a different way.
Economic segregation.
Economic segregation in a different way. than has been done before. And efforts previously were largely focused on where you lived only. And there could be analyses of residential segregation, but that didn't include interactions or anything that anyone was doing. And then there are these mobility studies that are largely infectious disease studies, like COVID transmission studies, where there is an infectiousness component of being near someone else. And there's no, you know, and so my question here was like, it's valuable on a descriptive level to build out that residential segregation component, that it's not just about where you live, that it's about your experiences during the day. But what is the, you know, and then the value. And so the implicit value here is that there is some value in seeing, even at a distance, people who are different from you, that there is a value to an individual at 50 meters to see someone, even if you don't know that they had any meaningful interaction or they spoke to each other or if they even passed each other, that seeing people different than you has some positive benefit. Also, the assumption there is that you could see at a distance who's different from you economically, which probably is not always true. Maybe sometimes it's true, but not always. And so that was kind of the implicit assumption here, that that was a good thing. And it probably is, but it's kind of like a halfway between the residential segregation models and then these infectious disease transmission models, where clearly something's going between two people that is negative. And we're like making a claim somewhere in between.
I had the same reaction to you. I mean, I do think there is value in that, right? I mean, I think people who have more empathy for people when they see people more often, you know, more supportive of policies that would be supportive of less economic disparity. So things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I do think there is value, but I agree with your point. Like this is resting on that assumption, at least it's saying we want to measure it to at least see people can decide for themselves. I would agree with your point that I don't know that we're saying here that we're putting value in just seeing somebody from a distance, right? I think the idea here would be we don't have the perfect measure. We can never on a scale this size determine whether or not two people are actually interacting with each other. But I think it's probably a reasonable assumption that the more people are within seeing distance of each other, the more likely it is that they are going to interact. And therefore, there should be more interactions in places where people are coming together more than places where they aren't. But, you know, I mean, that's an assumption. And it's, you know, it's theoretically testable, but there's no proof of that here.
Part of how I think about this is from some of our work, the most privileged people can always go wherever they want, do whatever they want. And so the state of affairs where those people never cross paths with people from lower socioeconomic strata is one in which those lower status people are systematically excluded from the most desirable spaces. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I think I was excited when these authors say, like, you know, what we found is that by design, you can create cities that foster greater mixing. I think sort of the lens I would tend to take on that would be, you know, that is a way of reversing policies and practices that have basically, you know, allowed privileged people to isolate themselves and hoard resources and sort of keep all the best stuff to themselves.
Yeah.
So I think I like that direction, the focus on urban design. And I think this paper maybe could have done even more to point out the gaps. Things that have been done, like denying public transportation access to certain neighborhoods or cities, denying access to treatment facilities or other needed resources, that, you know, sort of we can talk about sorting, but I think it's important to talk about how policy enables sorting.
Yeah. So I thought that this paper was weakest, and not to say it was weak, but just weakest in the places in that last section where it made what I think you could reasonably argue are causal claims. You know, the idea that we could reverse engineer this problem by doing things because we observe something in particular places isn't as strong to me, because what they don't have here is a situation where you say we had a place where there was a whole bunch of economic segregation. They built a shopping center and we saw it actively reduced. That's different from saying in the areas where there are these shopping centers, there was reduction because we don't know what was happening before. And we don't know if the same forces that prompted one to build the shopping center there are the same forces that were having people mixing already. We just don't know that. I suspect they're probably right, but to me, that's hypothesis generating. And I'd want to see some stronger evidence before I would conclude that we, you know, we can reverse engineer this problem through building cities in certain ways. But I don't doubt it. I really don't.
I thought it was one of their core points. And I agree with you that there is no kind of temporal pathway that they demonstrated to show that one causes the other and that they're not just kind of correlated in time or there's something else that might be causing that association. But what I do think was interesting about that observation with the POIs was that the points of interest was that it was not just linked to where people live, where many of the interventions on the policy level now focused on reducing segregation are focused around residential segregation and housing developments. And how do you, on a local level, for example, implement mixed economic level housing so that people of different income levels have access to live in different communities? And that seems to be one of the central approaches to economic integration right now is through housing. And so one of the eye-opening components of this paper was the idea that that's not the only thing you could try. And in fact, maybe that hasn't been as successful as the kind of zoning and location of these hubs that might bring people together for some sort of shared purpose or need.
So you're saying we should build more amusement parks? That sounds like what I'm
shopping
hearing.
Shopping centers, malls, maybe, or ballparks.
Amusement parks, more stadiums.
Some of them are limited, right?
Which are quite segregated internally, right?
Stadium on every block. That's what we need. That's what we need. Okay, a couple of points I just wanted to ask about. The first of which is, did either of you listen to the podcast Serial?
No.
Yes.
Okay, so Serial is it was this ongoing podcast series about a guy who was put in jail for a crime he claims he did not commit. And one of the things that I took away from that was pings of cell phones to determine location is not as accurate as you would think it should be, that there is a lot of measurement error when it comes to location through pinging of cell towers, because it's figuring out your location largely based off of, you know, triangulating between different towers, and it doesn't always get that right. And so it can put you in the wrong place. I don't know if that's true or not, but it just made me think when you've got a data set this large, and again, I don't have any specific reason to think that there would be a strong systematic bias here, but I do think that if you're living in an area with fewer cell phone towers, you're going to get less accurate information on location.
There also is some known biases in the SafeGraph data set.
This is what I was going to ask you about. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, and the SafeGraph data set in general is known to have fewer low-income people and fewer people of color, kind of representative of the general population. So
presumably, for one thing, you have to have a cell phone, right? So not most people have a cell phone, but not everyone. And presumably the better your cell phone, the better it's going to be at determining location. I don't know that that's true, but that's just my assumption based on, I feel like if I spend more on my cell phone, I should therefore, the GPS should be better, whatever it is. I don't know. I don't know exactly how it works. There's also consent required to be in this data set. I don't know that there's any reason to think that we know what, you know, who chooses to consent to be in this data set or not, but that, you know, that has the potential to introduce some biases. So
I think there's been some changes also in that data set since you've worked with it and I've worked with it. I think they gave it a different name. Mm-hmm. There may have been some controversies around seeing visits to certain sensitive locations. And so I think this is, and I also think that the move with especially iPhones towards opting out of apps tracking your locations may have had some influence in this space as well.
Yeah.
But overall, I mean, I do think smartphone mobility data have been really compelling in being able to show us something on such a large scale about even in an imperfect sample, the ways that people are spending time over the course of the day. It's with a just such an enormous sample of the total population.
Yeah. Any last thoughts before we move on?
So it's just an enormously dense analysis. I mean, I think more so than we commonly see. And it was an interesting paper. So I definitely encourage anyone who has an interest to check it out.
Yeah, the one thing, so they have a map that's got the segregation density, economic segregation density across the country. And the areas where you see the most are, you know, the area that we're in, the Northeast, has got a lot of it. The sort of the you know, Ohio, Chicago, that sort of area. I realize those are, one is a state, one is a city, but parts of Texas, Southern California. But what surprised me was not sort of the San Francisco area as much as I would have expected. It definitely has, you know, a fair bit of economic segregation, but not nearly as much as I would have thought that would have been a dark red, and it isn't. So goes to show you, you don't always know what you're going to get. All right. Shall we move on to our second segment? So in the second segment, we're going to talk about, and this is really just going to be a sort of more of a conversation, that we started with a short piece that was an opinion piece that was entitled AI for Hypothesis Generation by Derek Lowe, not the former pitcher for the Red Sox during our first World Series win, not that Derek Lowe, but an opinion. It was writing largely about a different one, but the basic premise was, and he was sort of making the point that he wasn't super, you know, overly impressed by these large language models, ChatGPT and those sort of things, in sort of their general function. You know, my take on that is I'm not overly impressed either. I'm somewhat impressed, but that's going to get better and better and better. You're super impressed by
that. That's where he lost me. I'm so impressed by them. I think they're so good.
So I have found so many times where if I don't know anything about a particular topic, it gives me like really specific information. If I know something about the topic and I ask it about it, it gives me very specific information, much of which is not right.
Mm-hmm. I've had that information.
That's where I get concerned. Like, not right. Okay, so I'm just taking on faith the stuff that I don't know about. I don't know how much I should be trusting it at this point. But again, I think this is going to get better and better and better. And so, you know, that's fine. But he was talking about the sort of idea of, you know, hypothesis generation, particularly generating really good hypotheses, right? So we can all come up with a very specialized and fine-tuned hypothesis that we want to test with, you know, an epidemiologic study. But to come up with sort of the large hypotheses that explain big things, it really sort of paradigm shifting type hypotheses, those are hard. And then there's sort of everything in between. And we live in a world where we're having more and more access to data. And so to me, the question that comes out of this is, if you've got large amounts of data and you've got these language models that could be, you know, designed and really trained to be able to generate lots and lots of hypotheses that might explain a particular observation in a data set, and then to systematically then go through and test each of those different hypotheses, could we make better advancements in science than what we do now, where we typically, we get, you know, we have a hypothesis, we test it. If we're, you know, if our hypothesis is right, great, then we've made incremental progress and we move on to the next one. If we're wrong, then we have to come up with an explanation and sort of, you know, go in a slightly mm-hmm. different route. Whereas, you know, maybe a more systematic approach where you've got computers that can actually think through this process, think through in quotes, of testing lots of different hypotheses. And that brings up all kinds of problems, right? You'd have to really think through how to make sure that this was doing it in a really systematic way, because, you know, you can come up with lots of false positives that a computer might then interpret as, you know, meaningful information when it isn't. But you could get around that with, you know, essentially testing and then retesting in new data sets. So like lots of different ideas. I just found the idea, you know, I find this idea that when I ask people, like, how many years do we going to have jobs? How long is it going to be before computers can come up with all the hypotheses faster than we can identify data sets that are already existing that it can use to answer these questions? And we are essentially, our jobs are going to be relegated to the point of generating more data for the computers to figure out the answers to the questions. And everybody tells me, no, that's not true. Computers cannot reason the way that we can. And I am not as convinced that that isn't 5 years away. So I'm just curious, your general thoughts about this idea of AI systems for hypothesis generation, but also this idea of, do we think we're going to get to the point where our jobs can effectively be done by AI systems? Take it away.
It's a really interesting question. I mean, I liked reading this paper. It was short and it was kind of tongue in cheek. And, you know, the question comes down to, as I was thinking about it in application to my work or to our work, you know, how high level are the hypotheses that we generate to test in our research, right? And he was making the claim that, you know, an AI algorithm can come up with a standard set of hypotheses. He was focused on bench science, yep, where you could kind of test all these different protein interactions and, you know, different life course thing. You know, you could have all these standard tests so that then the computer could kind of be a shorthand to help you come up with a standard set of hypotheses. And then the question is, if you're thinking about something really revolutionary, could AI do that? Could AI think of some really revolutionary hypothesis? And I didn't see why not necessarily, if there was some, you know, there has to be some precedent in some ways in the revolutionariness. But then it kind of made me a little bit sad because it made me think about the hypotheses that I typically test in my research, which are really not revolutionary, which, you know, I think
most
in terms
science
of
science is not. Most science is incremental.
Kind of, we think about, you know, you're trying to get a grant from NIH, and NIH typically is not funding really crazy, wacky hypotheses, revolutionary hypotheses.
Except they have certain mechanisms for that.
But generally speaking, no, they're looking for things that are kind of a quote, or, you know, safer bet, quote unquote, in that sense. But like moving science forward, but not something that's, you know, really wacky out there.
And by the way, I don't think that's a bad thing, right? We need both. We need people who are going to do really high risk, high reward stuff that's going to change the field occasionally and most of the time fail. But we also need a lot of incremental science that gives us just a little bit, you know, better. But anyway.
So that was the question of like, can AI generate those, you know, kind of high risk, high reward, wacky hypotheses? And I didn't see why not necessarily,
either.
But I don't know. He was making the case that he didn't think we were there yet.
I don't think we're there yet, but I don't think we're far away.
Yeah. I was a little unclear on sort of how what he was proposing differed from some of the other things that people say about, let's say, machine learning type research, where sort of data driven projects, where instead of, you know, this traditional model where maybe we have an idea of like the 12 variables that we want to test, and, you know, there's like two main exposures. Instead of that, we're going to come in with 1,000 that we can pull from various sources and just see what model fits best. And maybe that'll tell us something where we didn't want to specify so specifically the hypothesis up front. How this differs from that in the sense of the examples that he gives sounded to me like the AI would be coming up with new theory.
Right.
Right.
And testing hypotheses of sort of theories, sort of hypotheses that might advance a certain theory that has not yet been identified.
Yeah. That I'm skeptical on. That seems to me, I think it could do that in theory, while at the same time producing loads and loads of garbage that would be theoretically testable, useful to no one. And most of the time when it came up with a positive finding, it would be a false positive finding. So that I have, that part I'm still skeptical on how it's going to figure that out. But again, you know, I think this is a field that is going to advance so quickly. I mean, we went from, so I had a friend who I saw over the weekend who was super excited a few years back when his daughter took a computer programming course in college because she had never been interested in that as a field, was more interested in business. And he, you know, feels sort of really strongly that you should just have some good understanding of computer programming. When I saw him the other day, he said, I've completely changed my mind on that. Most code that you find on, like, say, GitHub now, like a huge percentage of it is AI generated code. Like, you don't actually need to know how to code. You need to know how to figure out what's the problem you want the code to solve. My point being, like, the change that has come about in 1 year from the introduction of these models to what we thought they, you know, computers could do a year ago compared to what they can do now, is totally different. And, you know, you're seeing it with like deep fakes and things that are coming out. Like, the advancements are going to be incremental. And I don't know that it won't be able to do, I mean, I'm being a little provocative, right? I don't necessarily think they're going to take over our jobs in 5 years, but I do think that the way that we use this technology in 5 years within our jobs is going to be dramatically different. And therefore our jobs are going to be dramatically different.
How do you use it now within your job?
Now I've just started to use these. So for example, to give you a concrete example, I am now teaching a course that we have always taught in SAS. I only know SAS. We have more and more students that they are our users. I have sat down this weekend and said to this, you know, ChatGPT, translate this program from SAS into R. And the beauty of that is I can then test it out, right? I can actually run it in R. I don't know much about R, but I know how to hit the run button. And I can see if it produces the same thing that I'm producing in SAS so that I can actually figure out whether or not it's actually doing. And most of the time it does. It doesn't always. Sometimes it, you know, just makes up things that don't actually exist in the software. But most of the time it does. And so I can actually, you know, I went from a situation where I was contemplating, do I have to get somebody else to teach this course or someone to teach it with me, to I can kind of figure it out. And that's just sort of one small example. I've used it for help in generating text for grants. Not that it was the grant, you know, it's not what I'm writing. It's language to get started, to give to my co-authors to say, you know, I couldn't get them to produce something. I sent it off and said, does this make any sense, right? Is this what you would do in this situation? And they said, no, yes, we'd do this. No, we would never do this. And even where you did, we changed this to this. And suddenly we've got a grant. Whereas, you know, a week before I couldn't get anybody to write anything. So I just think a lot of that, you know, the uses of this technology are just going to go so fast in terms of what we do now versus what we did a year ago.
It's made me wonder, listening to your comments here, if, you know, in terms of our focus in research, that we're always supposed to be very hypothesis driven in our science, and especially in our data analysis, like you're supposed to kind of come to the data with a pre-established hypothesis and then use that, you know, kind of use that approach and then analyze your data in that way, instead of doing the kitchen sink analysis to then generate what your hypotheses are. And it's made me wonder, kind of, to the extent these, you know, AI can really do those kitchen sink analyses or give you really quick code to analyze maybe many, many, many more questions than you would think of that are outside of the scope of maybe your core hypothesis.
Yeah.
And then wondering what the, you know, what the result of that is for quality.
Yeah.
But it gives you that power to not just be totally hypothesis driven.
Yep. Yep.
Pros and cons.
All right. We need to move on to our final segment, but I think we need to revisit this topic in 2 years and see if we look back at this and say, Matt was 100% right, or Matt was 99% right. That's what we need to do. Okay. So on to our amazing and amusing, which needs no introduction. I'll go first. I just a study that I saw that really interested me. So recently, my father-in-law and his wife went to Antarctica on a trip, and they saw lots and lots of penguins and were sending back pictures of all of the different kinds of penguins. And penguins are just cool, right? We have a whole bunch of penguins here in the aquarium in Boston, which is one of my favorite things to go and see at the aquarium.
A whole bunch of penguins right here in our studio.
We could have penguins here in the studio. You never know. So this was an article that the title is "The Penguin Survives on 4-Second Microsleeps Thousands of Times a Day." And what they found was that penguins, you know, presumably because of concerns about predators, can't, you know, sleep for any length of time, have to be on constant watch. I don't understand. I mean, lots of animals that are hunted have this problem all over. And the typical response to that is you shut down half the brain. Mm-hmm. And so you, like, that's how fish sleep, is my understanding, that half the brain shuts down and the other half is awake. So you can still see what's going on and be, you know, be aware of what's going on, but you need sleep. The penguin deals with this in a completely different way, which it takes 10,000 roughly micro naps of 4 seconds at a time throughout the day. And I just thought this was really kind of a fascinating. They end up sleeping 11 hours a day, but in these 4-second bursts. And somehow that works for them. And I was super fascinated by this because I have reached an age in my life where I do not sleep through the night. I sleep terribly compared to when I was younger. My kids wake up at like 10 in the morning, and I am just so jealous of them that they can actually even do that. So I wish that I could get 4-second micro naps and I would actually feel good and refreshed afterwards, and I don't. So if you were a penguin, you could spend 11 hours in 4-second micro naps.
You know, that's at odds with, I think, some of the narrative we have around penguins being very romantic, right? Like they pair off. And so you have this idea that, you know, they're just, you know, they're
maybe
like,
maybe that's how they
partners.
Maintain these lifelong relationships, is they spend half the time in micro sleep, micro napping.
Interesting hypothesis.
Interesting to get to AI.
Yeah,
right?
That's there
an interesting
you go.
Hypothesis.
There you go. All right. John, what do you got? Are you going to update us on The Bachelor?
No, I think at this point, if you haven't watched The Golden Bachelor, you probably won't.
Okay, fair enough.
No, you're a penguin. You could just lay it right out there. If you haven't watched The Golden Bachelor yet, you're a penguin taking a micro nap. Yep.
I found one that I thought was on point for our conversation about generative AI, which was a study by some researchers finding that ChatGPT often won't defend its answers, even when it's right.
Really? So
I find that in my own experience, it just backs off immediately and it's like, oh no, I made a mistake.
Yes, exactly. So these researchers designed, I think the experiment sort of pitted two GPTs against each other, but maybe that's not so important. But the one giving the prompts set up this complicated, not that complicated, but a math problem delivered in words. So it has a right answer, but it's kind of like a little complicated to get to it. And the other GPT would answer the question, typically with the right answer. And then the first one would respond saying, no, you're wrong. And then laid out reasoning for why they were wrong, but that reasoning was incorrect. So basically, it sort of confronts the answering GPT with the
wrong reasoning. Just so I understand, these are two GPTs talking to each other.
Yeah, that didn't feel so essential. Maybe that's just a way of generating more repetitions or something faster.
I like that idea though, because they must get lonely too, right?
And they don't need micro naps.
Yeah.
But they're conversing and basically, I guess 22 to 70% of the time, the one that had given the correct answer immediately backed off, as Jess said, and said, I'm really sorry. Like, let me
apologizes
try this again.
To me so much. It's really, yes. It so almost seems submissive. Like, you know, I want to be like, you know, you can get out of this like mindset of
this like, totally resonated with me.
They need therapy.
Right. I that might be right. I think it also resonated with my impression of ChatGPT, which is that it, you know, if you criticize it in any way, it immediately says, I'm so sorry. Right. You're absolutely right. Let me try again, please.
But that's how they lull you into thinking they're not trying to take over the world.
That's
when
what
they
I
are.
Was thinking. Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Wow. So, okay. So your experience as well, that they just, that
I
if
think
you
immediately,
say
if
wrong.
If I question, you know, even if I question like, where did you get that information from? Oh. It often comes back with, oh, you're right. That's not correct.
I just made it up. Yeah.
It's like a really insecure child. When you first ask a question, it's like, oh, certainly I can do this. check out this answer. And if you say no, I'm so sorry.
To go into this like reflexive apology sometimes that like as women we're supposed to not do of like, don't always apologize. And I'm like, stop apologizing. Have some courage of your conviction. This is what you said. Where did you get the data from? Right. I've had that frustration.
So I was on a call the other day for a group that's working on funding these AI and health space kind of thing. And there was a term, and I don't remember the term, but it was the term for, it was like zero, I don't know, I'll just make up like zero bombing or something, where you just like, you go into ChatGPT and you just ask it like this vague question. You know what you want, but you don't really think through and you just ask it anything versus when you give it a lot of good information, you're much more likely to get a good answer. And so that just got me thinking, like, how long is it before now we're going to actually have the classes where students are going to learn how to use ChatGPT in the most effective ways?
I think we should. Remember reading that another way to improve ChatGPT effectiveness is to tell it that you really need the right answer. Like, my career is riding on this. Like, you just kind of beg it, like raise the stakes, and it's more likely to give a correct answer.
Oh my gosh, that's troubling.
I've had these conversations though with my husband where he feels like, you know, the question like parenting, it's like, do you tell your kid to stay away from ChatGPT when they have to write an English essay? Or do you, like his, and I think they should stay away. And his feeling is like, no, we have to teach them how to use it. How to use it to get the best quality information out of it. And so it's this question of like, do you learn how to use it to maximize or do you avoid?
I'm with you, Jess, on this one. They should avoid using it. And the reason is, it's not that I don't think your husband is right, that they're going to need to use this, they're going to use it. It's the same reason why I insist my students learn to calculate, you know, standard errors by hand, even though I'm saying to you, you're never going to do this by hand. What I want is I want you to understand the process. so that when you go stick it into a computer later, you understand what it's doing, how it's getting the information, and you know when it's going wrong and what it means. If you never learn to write, you just learn how to tell a prompt how to write, you're not going to know what's good writing and what's bad writing. So, like, I'm fine with the idea that in the future, you know, most of us are going to, you know, have things written by a computer program. That's fine as long as we know how to revise it and edit it so that it is actually good.
Or is that just the philosophy kind of our generation? That,
it could be.
That the next generation, it doesn't matter who generates it. Like, you still have good quality writing.
Like writing your manuscripts and pen and ink.
No, but what I'm saying is I don't think we will get good writing. That's what I'm saying.
See,
I'm not saying that it matters where the good writing. If the if ChatGPT eventually gets to the point where it produces flawless, beautiful poetry, then maybe it's fine. I don't know. Jess, what do you got?
I have something totally ridiculous.
Good.
Along the lines of the Golden Bachelor. I was thinking John was coming in, Golden Bachelor, reality TV. So this is something light. It comes from my 4-year-old, actually, who's become obsessed with this Netflix show. Is it Cake? Have you heard this?
My kids have told me about, they don't watch, but they have told me about this.
So I've watched it with him and it's fascinating. So basically it's this guy from SNL, the one who plays Don Jr. If you have seen some of these SNL skits, he's very funny. And so it's like a comedian and he's the host of this show, and they have all these bakers, and they have the baker. These are professional bakers. And then they bake like household regular items. And then some of them are household regular items, and some of them are cake designed in to look like a bag of nachos or a shoe or a dollhouse or, you know, something like that, and very elaborate. And so in this mode of cakes being designed to mimic, not to look like a round cake with icing, but to mimic an everyday object. Okay. And then he has them guess which item is actually the cake and which is actually a chair.
And then they have to bite into the shoe.
And then he takes a bat and he smashes them, or like a knife, and he'll like cut into it, and like, and it's, that's just a baseball helmet. And he smashes it, right? And like my 4-year-old is transfixed by this. And then, you know, every once in a while, there's one thing and it's really the cake. And it's not like an actual chair, desk chair. It's cake. And it's like a phenomenon. Apparently it's the most watched show on Netflix right now.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. So you should check it out. But it resonated with me a little bit on this lens of like, why is this so interesting to us? And it has to do, you know, we've spoken a lot in this podcast about fraud, about, you know, kind of our like mild obsession with fraud, like how do you detect fraud? How do you know fraud when you see it? Can you, or can you not? Or, you know, how do you unravel fraud? And this is kind of like cake fraud, where the cake, you know, people are like, you're seeing these things and they don't look like cake. None of them look like cake, but one of them is fraudulently is cake. And that's masquerading as like a pair of glasses or, you know, something else. And you have to detect it. And I don't know. It's like a really interesting, I think there's also that sense of like, as he smashes it, is it going to be like a big explosion or like a squishy thing?
Yeah.
But it's so
they
interesting.
Never eat it.
They should have to bite into it. And if it's a shoe, they bit into a shoe. Too bad.
That's a funny twist. The contestants have to eat it. I think they eat, as people have asked this online, like, do they just like throw out all the cake?
Yeah.
I think they eat the cake. I don't think they make them eat the objects.
I want to see somebody have to bite into a shoe.
But apparently this is like a whole phenomenon now of like cakes that look like everyday objects.
Yeah.
And then like, can you tell as the viewer, what are the like the signals of fondant versus plastic? I don't know. Right.
And could a computer figure this out better than humans could?
Maybe. Or a penguin.
Well, penguins definitely could. I have.
Right.
Is a penguin cake. All right. Well, that is the end of our program. If you got any feedback on this or any other episode, or you want to suggest a study or a topic for us to take on, you can leave us a comment on the Population Health Exchange website at pophealthex.org. We want to thank Nick Guler at BU School of Public Health for sound production and editing. Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed it, and we hope you download our next episode.